Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Yes, good evening and welcome to the final program of the Bay Area Book Festival. My name is Kate Harrison and I am from the Berkeley City Council. I represent the downtown district of Berkeley. Thank you, and I'm here to welcome our speaker and our interviewer today. I am very pleased to welcome you to The Unbreakable Human Spirit, featuring Albert Woodfox, and Shane Bauer. One of the Angola Three, Mr. Woodfox endured over three decades of solitary confinement in a 9-foot cell for a crime that he did not commit. While his story has been profiled by many publications, tonight we have the distinct privilege of hearing directly from him. A committed activist while incarcerated, fighting for better conditions in prison, as well as campaigning for his own freedom, Woodfox remains an outspoken advocate, touring to speak about the cruelty of our criminal justice system. Woodfox will be interviewed by Shane Bauer, an award-winning investigative journalist and author of the book American Prison, which details his experience working undercover as a prison guard. He himself is a survivor of solitary confinement when he was arrested in Iran and held for 2 years in the notorious Evin prison. From the epilogue of Woodfox's just-published memoir, Solitary, comes these powerful words. To those of you who are just entering the world of social justice, welcome. To those of you who have spent years struggling for human rights and social justice, don't give up. Look at me and see how the strength and determination of the human spirit defies all evil. Please join me in welcoming Albert Woodfox and Shane Bauer.
Albert, before I jump in to question, I just want to say, you know, as you know, in this country we have 80,000 people in solitary confinement. Thousands of people have been in solitary for decades. I spent 4 months in solitary confinement, and for me to be sitting up here with you, interviewing you, is a huge, huge honor. Your story is so inspirational. Your book is just fantastic and was, you know, something I related to just in the smallest way, but thank you so much for doing that and for being here.
Thank you, Shane, and thank everyone for coming. You know?
So to start, you know, I just wanted to talk about where you spent most of your time in prison. You spent most of your time in Angola prison, which was a slave plantation that was then bought by a man after the Civil War who leased prisoners and put them to work on his cotton farm, and then was bought by the state of Louisiana and ran as a prison. You wound up there in the 1970s, right?
Yes.
Can you kind of just describe for us what Angola was like at that time?
Well, at that time, Angola had just been designated, I think, by the Justice Department as the bloodiest prison in America. It was a segregated prison. It was almost every day another prisoner either was being beaten by prison staff, some to death. There was a lot of prisoner-on-prisoner violence. There was an active sexual slave market going on. And there were, you know, corruption at the security level as well as the administrative staff, you know, food and clothing and stuff that was meant for the prison population was being taken and resold somewhere else.
And so a lot of the guards were prisoners themselves, right?
Well, yeah, you had an inmate guard system. And the only requirements were that you had a life sentence or 15,000 years, you know. And because they wanted you to be there a long time. So, and that was basically the only requirement, you know.
How did you initially end up at Angola? Just a little bit of kind of backstory.
Well, you know, prior to my political awakening and joining the Black Panther Party, you know, like most African Americans in my time, I had virtually no opportunities. So I turned to crime, you know, and it's one of the sorrows of my life that, you know, I made a victim of my own community and stuff. And it was one of my biggest worries when I found out, you know, I was going to be free, if whether or not my community would forgive me and accept me as being a part of the community again. And also, how would I function within my own family? You know, I have a beautiful daughter, 3 adult grandkids, and 4 great grandkids. You know? So I'm happy to see it on all counts. Everything is great. You know.
And how did you become a Black Panther?
Well, like everybody, I mean, you know, when the Panthers first came on the scene, you know, I mean, it just kind of like exploded across America. Mm-hmm. I had a peripheral awareness, but I had never had any personal contact. And so I was sentenced to a 50-year prison sentence for armed robbery. Mm-hmm. And I escaped, and eventually, you know, since during the days of my criminal life, I had went to Harlem. So I was familiar with it. So eventually, you know, I wind up in Harlem. But this was a different Harlem than the one I had been accustomed to. And that difference was the presence of the Black Panther Party and the members, you know. And it was the whole atmosphere, you know, there was a sense of pride. And the one thing that I noticed was, you know, up until that point in my life, I had always noticed right below the fear, the surface, the fear in African-American people, you know, because they you know, the possibilities of what could happen to them. You know, America was blatantly, brutally racist at the time. It has changed somewhat, but it's just a superficial change. And so, eventually from escaping the Paris prison I was in, and I wound up in Harlem, and I see it was a different kind of different Harlem. And I was still a petty criminal, still a knucklehead, and so I seen some, you know, Panther sisters, you know, and so I'm trying to, you know, hit on these women, and these women are talking about revolution and social struggle, and and I was like, huh, you know. And eventually, I was arrested for, you know, the extradition warrant. And while I was in there, Panther 21, as it referred to, occurred. And so four of the brothers from the New York chapter was put on the floor. I was on the 8th floor. Mm. And, you know, these brothers came on a chair. And, you know, in prison, you know, when someone new comes into the environment you're in, you know, they either become a victim or they're a victimizer, you know. And so people are looking at them. They're looking for weaknesses that can be exploited. You know, but these brothers came on a tear, and you know, and they went to, you know, talking about revolution and social struggle and Black determination and serving the people and stuff, you know. And at the time, you know, I was hearing what they were saying. I was listening, but I wasn't hearing what they were saying. I wasn't understanding what they were talking about. And the prisoner who had did 25 years, he had a 25-year life sentence. He became my cellmate. And in the process, you know, of talking with one another, he said, you know, I have a book I want you to read, you know. And the book is called A Different Drummer. Hmm. And that book virtually, you know, was the first step in the journey I'm still on now, you know. You know, all of a sudden, I wasn't just listening, I was hearing. what brothers, you know, brother in leadership, I'm sorry, he's no longer with us, but his name is Alfred Kane. And so, you know, at some point in time, you know, I made a commitment to you know, not Panther Party at that time, but a commitment to social struggle.
So you had been in and out of prison before this, and then you were turned on to the Panthers in New York, and then were sent back to Louisiana. Could you describe, you know, going back into Angola as a Panther, what changed? How was your experience in prison different from that point?
Well, I think what had changed was me. You know, we use the term my level of consciousness had been raised. I had been politicized by the members of the party that was on the tier. And I was also there, you know, when you had the uprisings in the 70s about, you know, the horrible conditions and you know, and both while I was in the Manhattan House of Detention. And after that, in spite of prompts, because I was, had, you know, become one of the so-called leaders of the tier, you know, otherwise I attended meetings with prison administration to speak about the conditions and stuff. And they assured us that, you know, nothing would happen. But in spite of that, after the, you know, the prison went back to normal, you know, they shipped me to New Queens. And several months later, you know, in the history in New York, you know, there was another uprising because of, you know, the conditions in all the five boroughs of New York, you know, the city jail was so horrendous. And you know, the brutality and the corruption and stuff, pretty much, you're in a position where you don't have no choice. You know, you either rebel and you try to make things better, or you just suffer endlessly.
Well, something that was really interesting to me about your book is how you write, you're pretty forthright about, you say in your book, at one point you wrote, there's no honor among thieves, and you're very honest about how difficult it is in prison to, you know, how new people coming in, you would advise them to be careful about, you know, sharing things or taking offers from help for prisoners because they might, you know, fall victim to a kind of, you know, what you described as a sexual slavery situation. But despite that environment, you also began organizing pretty quickly after you became a Black Panther. So how did you deal with that? That's an extreme contradiction, or, you know, just...
Well, you know, as you know, I'm a member of a political group called Angola 3.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, one of the members is no longer with us. Harmon Wallace died 3 days after winning his freedom. And so, you know, I actually joined the Black Panther Party, the New Orleans chapter. You know, my involvement in the uprisings in the prisons in Manhattan, the House of Detention in Queens, you know, at that during those time, anyone who rebel or challenge the powers that be were automatically determined by the administration to be a Panther, you know. So, but I actually didn't join the Black Panther Party until I was extradited back to New Orleans.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually, you know, because I was involved in another uprising there because of conditions, you know, bed bugs and roaches and rats, and, you know, pretty much the food was horrible. It was medical care was non-existent. And, you know, so, excuse me, you know, I was involved in an uprising there to make things better. So after that was over, you know, in the interim between me being placed there, they had a special tier for the New Orleans Panthers who had been in the shootout with the New Orleans police. So they put me on a tier with them. And they were aware of, you know, me and my activities in New York. And they welcomed me, and eventually, you know, I joined the party.
And you guys were doing some kind of organizing around in Angola around this sexual slavery issue.
Well, yeah, you know, what's motivated that is, you know, the unit I was living in was called Hickory. And right across from me with this young kid came, and he could have been no more than 16, 17 years old. And, it was, you know, having raised, I'm sure it existed around me, but I didn't have the political awareness or the consciousness to recognize another human being who had his spirit broken. And so I saw this kid sitting across from me. And I think one of the saddest things I've ever seen is a human being who has had their spirit broken. And, you know, so I went over and I talked to him, and he finally told me what happened, that three guys had raped him. And, you know, and so it bothered me. It bothered me. So the next day I talked to Harmon Wiles, and, you know, and he said, well, we can do something about this. You know, this is not nothing. It's going to be dangerous, and it's possible that, you know, we can be hurt, or we may have to hurt somebody, but we can do something about this. So we had established the only recognized chapter of the Black Panther Party in a prison. And so our technique of holy meeting stuff, we used to go out on a football field like we were playing football and hold political classes and stuff. So we, you know, got out there together, and we talked about it to all the members of the prison who had joined the prison chapter. And we decided that, you know, starting the next fresh, they call it Fresh Fish Day, it was every Thursday, when prisoners come in from the process into the prison population. And so we decided that we would, you know, go there and talk with some of the young guys, particularly who was coming in, and if necessary, offer physical protection against being raped. And so, you know, what we would do is when they come, you know, we would, you know, in a loud voice announce ourselves, who we were and why we were there, and, you know, start telling them what they not to do, what the thing that guys used to, you know, put them in a position and then you gang them and rape them and stuff. And you know, let them know that if they needed any kind of physical protection, to come to us. And, you know, so we pretty much stopped that for a while, you know.
How did the prison administration react to you guys doing that?
You know, it was strange because, you know, Angola is a former slave plantation. So you still have people work there that go back 10, 15 generations, all the way back to chattel slavery. And the power base in Angola has always been a member from one of those families. Louisiana had its first female Department of Corrections secretary. So she was trying to break that grip. So she brought in, you know, a warden from outside. His name was C. Murray Henderson. And in turn, he brought in staff from outside. So at the time, you had this power play going on between the two different factions, you know, the faction that came in and the family, old families. And so that gave us an opportunity to do a lot of the organizing we were doing. And because they were so concentrating on who was going to run Angola,
right.
You know, they didn't, you know, have time to concentrate on us.
What was the first time that they approached you to talk to you about your membership in the Black Panther Party?
Well, they never did, and it was strange because, as I said, you know, developing the level of consciousness and political awareness and stuff, you know, I was just another petty criminal, you know. And so, but I had established a reputation. So when I went to Angola, a change of man, you know, the respect that I had garnered in the game, as they call it, allowed me to talk to guys who normally wouldn't listen, and you know, and do things that normally, you know, I wouldn't have been able to done. It, or I'll say this: it would have been much, much more difficult. And so, you know, when I left, as I said, I joined the Black Panther Party in the Paris prison in New Orleans. And a guy named Charles was in leadership position. And so when they came around that earlier that night and told me I was shipping out, you know, so him and I went set off and talked, you know, and I'm like, you know, what do I do now? And he said, well, do what you've been doing, you know, educate, agitate, you know, raise level of confidence, give the guys a sense of self-worth, mm-hmm. dignity, pride, you know, just be a Black Panther, you know. And so that's when I went to Angola. I mean, I already knew what Angola was like because I had been there previously as a young teen for a cartel charge. And so, as I said, you know, when, you know, I was put in population, you know, I would start talking about, you know, and I imagine they felt like I did when I was hitting on these sisters, you know, and, you know. But I think the way I carried myself and the principles and the values that I live by and stuff, some of them began to, you know, most of them thought this is just another part of the game, you know. You know, when I wouldn't participate in certain things and spoke out against certain things, and, you know, they began to take me serious, you know. Mm. And so a lot of men, you know, started, you know, asking about the party and how could they, you know, support. And from there, you know, we started organizing, you know, for food strikes and work stoppages and stuff like that, you know, writing letters to the press about what was going on in the prison and you know, just generally, you know, analyzing whatever condition that exists and then trying to find a solution.
Something that's struck me in my reporting on prisons is something that comes up over and over again in states across the country is that is the ways that the prison administrations are threatened and very openly threatened by Black political consciousness or prisoners who even study African-American history. You know, there's found by new people in long-term solitary confinement here in California that had been put there because they were said to be gang associates, partially because they had Black Panther books. Yeah. In Louisiana, when I was working undercover as a prison guard, we got a list of the books that were banned, and there was one that was called 100 Years of Lynching, and it was just a collection of news articles about lynchings. And, you know, these things are banned because they say it affects the security of the institution. It's just so naked, and I think your situation is really, you know, is such an extreme example, but in some ways typical, you know, because you were such a, you know, a bold voice. You ended up locked away for 44 years.
Yeah, well, you know, Angola is a unique situation because it was a former slave plantation. Yeah. And like I say, you got about 15 families that go all the way back to chattel slavery. So the attitudes and the racism is in particular against African Americans is passed on from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. You know, and at the time they had virtually like all the civil jobs were filled by white prisoners. Mm-hmm. You know, the only jobs that the blacks had were mostly in the field. Where you got paid like 2 cents an hour, for backbreaking agriculture work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a lot to organize against in Angola, you know. And as I say, you know, I had made a commitment to the Black Panther Party and to social struggle. And so, you know, I did, you know, based upon the readings and the training of the party, you know, I organized, I educated, I agitated, and, you know, against the brutality of the security force. You had something like 5,000 men being controlled by 300, and well, they used to call them free men.
Right.
And the inmate guards who were so brutal. I mean, you know, they were even more brutal than the correctional officers who was working there, you know. And so, you know, I just took it head on, me and Harmon, you know, and eventually the men who joined the chapter of the Black Panther Party. The other member, Robert Hillary King, he wasn't even in, it wasn't even in Angola when this correctional officer was found murdered. And but when he came about a week or so later, they locked him in solitary. So he spent 29 years in solitary, and he only got out after he had his case overturned.
Talk about how you ended up in solitary. What led to that?
Well, I was the first one that had been arrested. I had been involved in organizing a work stoppage that morning because of my job was in the scullery in the dining hall. You know, I used to clean the pots that they used to cook food and stuff. But they were working guys like 16, 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and they were, you know, complaining amongst each other about. So, you know, I took the initiative and started explaining, the unity of strength of unity. And they had, you know, the human rights. They had still had minimum constitutional rights. So, you know, and they had the right to be treated in a humane way. And so they had to do something to cause the administration to be faced with a situation of, you know, the one thing about prison is they're trying to keep everything in-house. So if they can keep everything in-house, then they can control, you know, the process and pretty much dictate the outturn, outcome of that situation. So they're very reluctant. Probably the most painful form of protest is hunger strikes. And, you know, work stoppages and stuff, you know. And so that morning, you know, when we got to what's called a snitcher gate, is the last security gate before you go into the dining hall. They turned everybody around and said, you know, the prisoners were refusing to serve anybody. And, you know, but I mean, I knew what was going on. So I went back to my dormitory. And I was, you know, where I work, you work one day on, one day off, because it's a very dangerous job. You cleaning pots and pans and stuff, and you're dealing with a lot of scalding hot water, you know. And it was very hard, very, very hard work, you know. And so this was my day off, you know. So I went back to the dorm, laid down. I think I fell off to sleep, and I don't know, maybe a half hour, you know, I woke up because the security people was screaming and hollering and blowing whistles, and, you know, they was using the N-word, all you niggas get on the, line up on the walk and stuff, you know. And so, you know, I was on very last unit on what's called a walkway, you know, it's a concrete thing that go down with units on each side, you know, oak, pine, walnut like it there, you know, and I was on the very last unit. So we lined up, and on the way down there, you know, word started filtering back down the line that they had found a correctional officer stabbed to death in a pine unit. And so I was the very first one that was locked up for an investigation, you know, for Mr. Miller's death, and eventually Harmon, you know, and stuff. And some of the members who had joined the Black Panther Party, we had established and stuff, you know. And, you know, there was a lot of beatings and just sheer terror. And it was only of the black prisoners, you know. They didn't interrogate any of the white prisoners or brutalizing them or anything, you know. So I was put in the dungeon, what's called, we refer to it as the dungeon. It's a strip cell, you know, and you don't have any personal items or anything. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you was getting like 2 slices of bread 3 times a day. But I was placed in there, and it was April 17th, 1972. And the next day, April 18th, I was transferred from the dungeon to what's called CCR, closed cell restriction, which is solitary, you know. Mm-hmm. And you, in solitary, you're housed in a cell 23 hours a day. You get 1 hour a day to come out the shower. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we first were placed in solitary confinement or CCR, you were only allowed to have like a couple of change of underwear, some slippers, and nothing else, you know, and a Bible. Yeah, you put a Bible on the table. You wasn't allowed to get newspapers, magazines. No, you wasn't allowed radios or anything, TVs or nothing, you know.
You write about the kind of, you wrote that the fear that I might start screaming and never stop was always with me. That was something that I really related to from my short time in solitary, this feeling that you're just kind of trying to keep that possibility of snapping at bay. You did that for so long. I mean, how did you kind of, was that continuing, you know, was that fear always there that you might kind of panic? And how did you?
I mean, it's there now. I mean, I still, you know, I still suffer from claustrophobic attacks. Yeah. I'm able to deal with them better now because of the fact that I can walk beyond 9 feet. Mm. But you know, yeah, I mean, you know, how you never adjust to being locked in a 9 by 6 cell for 23 hours a day. And I was in solitary longer than, you know, Harmon and I, longer than any other prisoner in the history of the United States.
Yeah.
I was in solitary for 44 years and 10 months, you know. And I think what helped us was that, you know, we were not glued into the prison culture. You know, we were Black Panthers. We had a political conscience, a political awareness. So we had a foundation to work with. And so I think that helped. And, you know, and what really helped me, though, is, you know, when I was a young kid, teenager, my mom was trying to teach, you know, me values, you know, loyalty, devotion, dignity, pride, self-respect. And, of course, like most teens, I rebelled against that. And, you know, I always say that the voice of the street was louder than my mama's voice. Mm-hmm. And the voice of the Black Panther Party was louder than the street. And so the Panthers gave me purpose, focus, you know what I mean? To my knowledge, the Black Panther Party is the only political organization that would allow someone in prison to become a part of it, you know, as long as they upheld the principles and the philosophy of the Black Panther Party. So I think that had happened. But for me, it was still a struggle. Yeah. I really didn't. You know, I was in my early 40s when all of the wisdom and education, self-education, allowed me to understand the principles that my mom was trying to teach me, and you know, the strength, and it gave me strength. It was the foundation in which I was able to, you know, progress as a human being. And, you know, And so, you know, we had a lot of respect from the prisoners in Angola because of what we were trying to do. So that automatically put us in what I guess you could say a leadership position. So that put tremendous demands on us, because in order, you know, to be in a leadership position, we had to be able to lead. We had to have a knowledge, you know, and wisdom, and you know, and know how to organize the men we lived around. The tiers in CCR was, you know, you had 15 men on a tier, and you had about six tiers of CCR, you know. And so, you know, that I think that gave us an advantage over the average prisoner, because the average prisoner is glued into the prison culture. Harmon and Robin and myself, we instinctively knew that if we were going to survive solitary confinement, that we had to turn outward. We had to let whatever values we had be shaped by society and what was going on in society, not turn inward to the prison culture, and no longer be concerned about society and how it was being shaped and whatever, you know. And so in turn, you know, we organized the tiers we were on, and we developed, educational classes. You know, I think I've been asked what's the proudest. I think is my proudest achievement. You know, and my proudest achievement was the first man I taught how to read and write. You know, and I think, you know, and I remember his name was Charles, and I remember one day we were sitting down and he was reading. And he stopped, you know, and he looked at me. He said, "Man, you done opened up the world to me," you know.
Yeah.
And that always stuck with me. It always was a motivation for other men that we taught how to read and write, taught about history, you know. And we had to devise ways of teaching men who didn't know what unity was, didn't know the strength that comes from unity and stuff. So you have to be creative and we used to have like discussions every day. We would pick a topic to talk about, and you know, and so we were able to raise the level of conscience. Of course, we lost way more battles than we won, because I had the unfortunate of seeing so many men go insane, and men kill themselves, men cut themselves, injure themselves just to get out the cell. Or in their mind, they think that's going to get them out of CCR, but you just take them to the hospital and patch them up and bring them back, put them right in the cell, you know. And guys go, insane. And usually when a guy loses it, you know, he starts screaming. And he folds himself into a fetal position. You know, either on the floor of his cell or on his bunk or something like that, you know. And so that was a constant challenge to me, you know. The fact that I had been self-educated, the fact that, you know, I was political, the awareness made me know that the possibility was even greater. And so, there were times I used to wonder, is this going to be the day?
Yeah.
You know,
it seemed like, I mean, just this idea of kind of struggling against something in prison, even if you're losing, it just seems so key. When I was in prison for 2 years, I was with two other people, and it was exactly the same. I mean, we always had something, whether it was like trying to get a phone call or trying to see each other, you know, some little battle. And that really, I think more than anything, kept me sane, just having that kind of thing to push against all the time. Because there was also, I'm curious if you experienced this, you know, other than this fear of that kind of panic and breaking down, there was a seduction to just letting go. And like, I could get into a state where I'm like, just not really thinking and just kind of like floating and waiting for the time to pass. And it's like I'm disappearing almost. And if I wasn't diligent about not doing that, that would just be the natural course. And I think that's how a lot of people would just slip into this kind of insanity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're being confined to, you know, a lot of people ask me what it's like, and I always tell them, just try to stay in your bedroom for 23 hours.
Yeah.
Or go out in the backyard and draw a 9x6 square and stay inside that square for 23 hours. Yeah. And you'll never really know unless you experience it, but you'll have some idea of what the men and women and children who are placed in solitary go through, you know. And so, you know, I mean, a lot of the worries that I had, the fact that I'm out now, are still with me.
Yeah.
You know, you can't lock a person up for almost 45 years in a 9x6 cell and don't do some damage, you know. But as I said, the qualities of a humanity that my mom instilled in me became the foundation, and the awareness and the determination of the Black Panther Party, gave me a tool to use. So a cell that was meant to be a death chamber, I turned it into a high school and a college and a law clinic and a debate hall, you know, and so... that's how I was able, to first maintain my sanity and to function at a very high level of moral principles and values and develop a unbelievable self-discipline. And as I said, I think I was like in my early 40s, around 41 or 42, when the values and principles, that I had been living by all that time, I internalized, and they became a part of every fiber of me, my heart, my soul, you know, my mind and stuff. And it was like I recommitted myself. I'm like, so whatever it takes, I won't let these people break me. I won't stop what I'm doing, and even if it's me losing my life. And so that's pretty much how, I live my life in solitary. And I think, it helped me to grow as a human being and to transform, a pretty thing, in the book, at the front of the book, there's a poem called Echoes. And it's about my relationship with my mom, and it pretty much says everything, So that's pretty much how, I lived my life for almost 45 years.
Yeah. I'm curious. I think in America we have Americans really like stories of triumph and people that go through hardship and come out on the other end better and stronger. Your story is one of those stories. But I'm curious what it's like for you to be... you have this opportunity to be a kind of spokesperson and a representative for people who are in this experience, but at the same time, you're very unique, because most of these people are not coming out like you are. So what is it like to kind of, have that role and maybe responsibility and be in this position that you're in now?
Well, it's a tremendous pressure. I feel a tremendous amount of pressure. But I remember, not verbatim, I remember reading something that Nelson Mandela said. He said, if a cause is noble, you can carry the weight of the world. I developed this unbelievable love for humanity. And so I dedicated my life to bettering humanity, to help build a better humanity and therefore a better society and stuff, And so... that was a, even now, I'm sitting before all these people and I'm asking them to listen to me and maybe follow my example. I'm trying to start a narrative and a movement stop the use of solitary confinement because it serves no purpose other than to break men and women and children you know, and the brutality of prisons, the way, you know, and my challenge is to the judicial, against the judicial system in this country, which is racist and arbitrary and capricious. And it's so strange, but people believe they can go into the court system and get justice. The court system does not believe in justice in America, you know. The American judicial system is more concerned with due process. So guilt or innocence or justice is not a part of the philosophy of the courts. As long as you send an innocent man to prison, as long as you do it a certain way, then that's all they're concerned with. You know, it's the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, you know, due process, equal treatment, and protection under the law. So long as you can create the illusion that, you know, you're concerned with guilt or innocence or justice, then, you know, are we going to continue to have the type of judicial system we have?
Yeah.
And when I say judicial system, you know, I mean the courts, the district attorney's office, the police department and stuff, you know.
Yeah. I think that, you know, a lot of people, if they, you know, weren't familiar with your name or Robert or Herman, they may have been familiar with the term Angola 3. There, you know, there was a really large movement around you three, and I wanted to know if you could talk about that and the role of non-prisoners in prison organizing.
Well, you know, about, you know, 40-something years ago, Robert Herman and I had come to the understanding that people in prisons and people in, especially in solitary confinement, had no voice.
Yeah.
And nobody knew what they looked like. They were hidden behind the walls of prisons. Mm. And so we said not if, but when we got out, we would spend the rest of our lives being that voice, being that face. You know, I think a lot of, you know, the state has had so many decades of being unchallenged and shaping the narrative of what people in prison are. And to the point where relatives forget that prisons don't come from another planet. They come from families, starting with the mother. And, you know, and so the men and women and children in prisons are somebody's brother, sister, uncle, grandfather, grandmother, daddy, mother, you know. And they warrant the love and support of their family. And I know economic plays a lot. And, you know, it's particularly in African Americans not being able to give that, you know, kind of support. But, you know, it's up to the community, you know, the institutions, you know, that people rely on, particularly poor people, to organize and find ways to make it possible for these people to, you know, go to prison and visit and stuff, you know. And, you know, so that's pretty much, you know, what I'm trying. I mean, we're known for surviving solitary confinement, but we speak of issues like most American citizens don't know that. Under the 13th Amendment, slavery is still legal in this country. You know, and that a prisoner constitutes a slave of the state.
Yeah.
And they have no human rights, no very minimum constitutional rights. And, you know, so they, you know, and prisons, just like all state institutions, and that's what we have a problem in this country right now, no citizen oversight. Either through the citizens themselves or the political leaders that they elect, there's no oversight. So unchecked power always corrupts. And that's what happened. That's what's happening in the judicial system now. Unchecked power. From the police to the district attorney to the judges, you know. One of the questions, you know, I get a lot is the jurors who convicted me.
Yeah.
how do I feel? You know, and I'm like, well, I feel sorry because the people that sit on juries are citizens. They are, you know, have the best intentions. And but they are making decisions based upon evidence that was manufactured or corrupted evidence or lies, you know, and so I can't blame them. You know, someone asked me once, how did I feel about the Miller family? You know, mm-hmm. their pursuit for 40-something years.
The family of the guard
yeah.
who was murdered, yeah.
Brent Miller,
right.
yeah. And I don't hate them because I understood this was a member of their family. You know, I have to ask myself, what would I do if my brother, you know, of course they were wrong, and they totally ignored the evidence, the overwhelming evidence mm-hmm. that, you know, proved that we were innocent. I mean, they have a bloody fingerprint on the door of the dormitory, and they only matched it against us, and when it didn't match us, they stopped looking.
Right.
You know? And my case, which is almost unheard of, my case was overturned 3 times.
Yeah.
4 if you count the one that stuck. You know, the U.S. the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they upheld my right to a new trial. So, you know, as long as I say, if the people don't hold the men and women who work in social institutions, whatever they are, they don't hold them accountable.
Yeah.
Then, you know, that's unchecked power. Mm. And if they will continue to do the things they're doing.
Yeah. You know? There's a passage at the end of your book that was just so powerful to me. You say, this is after you got out, you say, to be in my physical body in the physical world again was like being newly born. I had to learn to use my hands in a new way, for seatbelts, cell phones, to close doors behind me, to push buttons in an elevator, to drive. I had to relearn how to walk downstairs, how to walk without leg irons, how to sit without being shackled. It took about a year for my body to relax from the positions I had gotten used to holding while being restrained. I allowed myself to eat when I was hungry. Gradually, over 2 years, I let go of the grip I had held against feeling pleasure. I held against feeling pleasure, and of the unconscious fear that I would lose everything I loved. Can you talk a little bit about coming out?
Well, being in solitary, it's all about routine.
Yeah.
And one of the routines is you're never allowed out your cell without having restraints on your hands. You know, they either chain your hands to your stomach or to your side, and having on leg irons. And you know, leg irons, you can't have a full gait. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like a shuffle, the way you walk. You know, and so, you know, I hadn't lived amongst a family, although I had support from my family. I not lived amongst, you know, a family. I hadn't lived in a house. One of the things I did do when I was released is, you know, one of my brothers lived in Houston. I call him my rock because in 44 years, he never missed a month visiting, you know. And his name is Michael. And so we talked, and he said, well, why don't you come stay with me? And, you know, my sister-in-law, and you can learn about what it is to live in a house, live with your family, you know, all these things I had been denied for so long, you know. And so that's what I mean when I say I had to learn pretty much how to be a human being again, you know, because I had been treated like an animal, even though I wouldn't accept that treatment. There were certain things I had no control over, you know. It was 20 years before I was able to touch my mom when she visited, or hug her, or touch her, or my sister, or my brother when they visit, you know. And so I think my biggest adjustment was, you know, CCR, or closed cell restriction, is solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. And it's a cell with bars. It's not a complete concrete. Yep. And that's unique. And so I've always had to just for, you know, 4 decades plus, I had to just defend the front of my bars, you know, my cell, you know. So when I got out and, you know, so much publicity about the A3 or angle of 3 and stuff.
Yeah.
So when I went to events, I felt extremely uncomfortable with people moving around me because I had never had to deal with that, you know. And a lot of people know you, they read about you, and they actually think they know you. So I had a lot of people coming up behind me, bear hugging me and slapping me on the back. Or show, I mean, you know, the best intentions, but, you know, in prison, that could get you killed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so, you know, that was my biggest adjustment. My biggest disappointment was it took me about 3 weeks to realize nothing had changed in Angola, that racism, individual, institutional, and a systemic application of racism was the same, was very much a part of the fiber of this country, that the only changes were mostly in technology, and the social changes were mostly superficial. You know, they had found new ways to use the N-word.
Yeah.
And, but the meaning was just as evil and just as you know, destructive as it was when I left. And that was, you know, really a disappointment, you know, because my, you know, King used to use the term that to a frog, the world is no bigger than the opening of a well. And so my, although I knew about what was going on in the world, I knew about the change, I really had no experience with it until I got out. And it made me so sad, but it also made me question myself, you know, because I'm like, are you looking at society right? Or is this really how it is? Or is this, you know, maybe some suppressed anger or something that's dictating how you're seeing society? And then Donald Trump come along. And, you know, I pat myself on the back. I'm like, yeah, you were right. You know?
Is there anything that you miss from inside?
In a strange way, you miss the comradeship, you know, of guys you live around. I mean, you're living around someone, you know, for decades, you know, and you only get, you know, one hour a day to say hello or to see them when you come out and you're on your way to the shower, you know, or stuff, you know. So you develop some real close bonds, you know what I mean? Like Charles Nolan, you know, who I taught how to read and write, the first man I taught to read and write. My mom was functionally illiterate. She could only read or write her name. And people who can't read or write develop certain defense, you know. And so I was able to recognize in him, from observing my mama, you know, raised, coming up in the family. And so one day I just asked him, you know, and he eventually, you know, admitted it. And I said, well, we can do something about that. You know, if you really want to learn how to read and write, I can teach you. And so he wanted it. And, you know, my mom used to always tell me that change is 10%, 100% desire and 10% doing. And I, you know, explained to him, you know, I'm like, I'm not going to run behind you, but I will be there for you no matter what time of night or day, you know. And he put me to the test, too, you know, because he used to call me like 2 or 3 in the morning, you know. How you pronounce this word? You know, I use the dictionary. And, you know, at the end, all dictionaries at the bottom page, there's a pronunciation keys and how a word is, you know, sound as to how it's spelled and stuff. And taught him about, you know, vowels and adjectives and how to shape and form his words and stuff, you know. But he wanted it, you know. It, so in 6 months' time, he was reading at a high school level, you know. So, and there were so many other men after that. You know, that we taught to read and we taught the history. I mean, when we would teach black history, they were like, they had no idea the role that, you know, black people play in the development and advancement of society, not just in America, but in the world. Mm. And they had no knowledge of, you know, the only image they had of Africa is the image that you see in movies and stuff, mm. you know. And so, you know, that was, yeah. you know, played a great role in helping, you know, us to save some of the men mm. that we lived around.
Yeah. Let's open it up for questions, see if people have questions. We have about 15 minutes. Thank you. Do we have a mic for questions, or?
I can speak pretty loudly. Is that
I can hear you.
Oh, they want to. I think they're recording, so.
Oh, okay.
I think we need the mic.
I have to hold it.
Should we just have people line up back there who want?
That'd be great.
Okay, if anybody wants to have questions, if you can get in line back there. Excuse me.
It's a real short question. How did you achieve so much 1 hour a day of freedom?
Well, the majority of what I achieved was the 23 hours in my cell. You know, because, you know, that's where I, you know, re-educated myself. I taught myself, you know, criminal and civil law. I taught myself how to understand the language of the court system and how it operates and stuff. And, you know, I became a very avaricious reader. You know, I mean, there was a time when I was reading like 12 books a week. And so that all of that played a part. And then it was the kind of literature that I was reading. As I say, the book that changed my life was a book, fictional piece of work, that was based upon the Great Migration from blacks from the South to other parts of this country. But from that book, I learned that one person can make a difference. And I never understood. I had that concept, had been introduced to that concept in life, you know, what, you know, African Americans were allowed to learn and were very, very, very limited in America at that time, you know. So that's pretty much, you know, how, you know, I became the man that's sitting here tonight, you know.
But you helped other people. One hour a day, you taught a guy to read.
Well, what happened is the cells had a bar system. It wasn't a completely enclosed concrete cell, which was unique about Angola. So you were able to talk to guys next to you or shout up and down a tier. So Charles was about two cells from my cell. So he could speak in a normal voice, and, you know, I would be able to hear him, you know.
Should we take a question from back there?
That'd be fine. Oh, we're on. Yeah, we're on.
Can I see a show of hands? The state of California court system provides to every Californian free mediation, 80% successful. No one knows that. So the criminal system is totally fucked up, but the civil system, and my question of you is there any way for me, obviously I haven't helped you, I must be a sadist, is there any way for me to put a smile on the face of someone in prison other than secretly telling him that I'm suing the guard that kicked him yesterday?
Well, I don't know, you know, I'm still waiting up to know what it feels like to benefit from the Constitution of the United States. Statutory law, you know. I'm still trying to wonder what it feels like to be treated like a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, all these are first time experiences for me. So, for me, everything is about struggle. What is your economic, social, legal, you know, political, whatever. You know, I think that, you know, we live in a society where the individual is more important than the group. And I think that, you know, we have to develop a level of consciousness, develop a moral compass that will allow us to come together and fight against that, to fight to change the ideas and practices of the men, women, and children in this country, you know. But we have to develop a level, and when I say level of consciousness, overwhelming majority of the men and women in prison are economic prisoners. And we say the economic prisoners because we live in a society with an economic system that, you know, almost it divides people on the line of class, race, gender, stuff, you know. So the policies are almost guaranteed. You know, when in my generation, it was guaranteed, it had been determined that one out of every four black men would be in prison. It was my unfortunate to be that one out of four. And I think the great thing about becoming politically aware and developing a level of consciousness that I realized that I was not a bad person, that I was not a criminal, that I was in prison, but prison wasn't in me, you know. And I realized that there were social forces at work in this country that determined that I would wind up in prison. And so once I was able to figure that out, you know, it was easier for me to build, you know, moral principles and dignity, pride, self-respect. One of the reasons, you know, I struggled so hard in solitary and in Angola and even now is that every morning when I get up and look in the mirror, I don't want to be ashamed of what I'm looking at, you know. And so that's one of the motivating factors in, you know, me, you know, doing what I'm doing, you know.
Thank you. I want to thank you so very much for your life and what you've written and what you're saying. It's really profound. I want to also ask you on a lighter note about the movie called Black Panther, and if you've seen it and what you think it says about so much of what you've just mentioned, for example, respect and dignity.
Well, I haven't saw the movie. I'm aware of it, but I haven't saw it. But I have saw a documentary on the Black Panther part that I thought was, you know, pretty decent. You know, the thing about movies and books are they're subjective. You know, there are other people expressing their views about whatever to the rest of the world, you know. All I can tell you is that, you know, I'm a Black Panther. Once a Panther, always a Panther. It's one of the proudest moments in my life. And I'm so happy now. It's taken 50 years, but the true image of the Black Panther Party is beginning to be discovered by society, the contributions that they made. You know.
Hi, Mr. Woodfox. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for all of your work. My name is Amber, and I do work around criminal justice system reform. And one thing I really struggle with is I believe we need to divest from the prison industrial complex and really invest in the things that we know help our communities thrive. And if we want to do something about jail conditions, as I understand it, that would require investing further resources to make sure that people have humane food, humane medical care, etc. So this is a tension I bump up against a lot in my work, and I'm curious if you have thoughts or reactions to that.
Well, you know, fortunately, there are the men and women and children who feel the same way you did. And to find those people, or either, you know, by joining organizations, political organizations or social organizations, or developing or starting one yourself and struggle, you know. There's no shortcut, you know. Change requires social struggle. I embrace the philosophy of materialism and dialectics, which teaches that contradiction is the motivation for change. So, you know, what that means to me is that I don't see life as being black or white. I see life in constant transition and adjustments, you know. And so you pretty much answer your own question, you know. You find people that think like you, and you develop programs, policies, and stuff. But, one thing I always say is that we have got to stop electing officials because we agree with one thing out of 100 that they stand for, you know. We have got to start doing research and find out everything that's possible about, because we are putting these people in a very powerful position, you know, and we should not. And, you know, I think that in time, the American citizens should develop a way to make it more easier to remove these politicians when they become, you know,
What do you think about what she asked in terms of, you know, should we be focusing on kind of taking money out of prisons? You know, we have this overinflated prison system, or should we be trying to put more money in to, you know, improve conditions? Or how do you deal with that kind of tension?
Well, I think prison, you know, all social institutions, they start with oversight. Now, money, if it's not properly used, you know, or if those who you give that money to are not held accountable, or, as I said, just not make it easier to remove these people, you know, or to punish these people, then, you know, you just, you know, become what they call it, inertia, going round and round in circles, you know. So you have to, the community, through the public leaders or whatever, have to be able to shape the narrative, shape the policies of prison. You know, the one question and the answer that we used to always tell a guy, you know, Angola has some of the most creative and talented people in the world. As a matter of fact, they have hobby craft festivals twice, and each one of them makes over $1 million. So that tells you the quality of the skills that these men and women have developed. My question is, why does a prison have to bring this out of an individual? Why not high school and junior high school? Why not our public institutions are not designed to bring this skill or this talent out of people, you know?
Mr. Woodfoss, first, thank you for your service for Black liberation and just being a model for that consistency and dedication. I want to ask you a question about George Jackson. And did you have communication with George Jackson, the Soledad brothers? And how did you manage that tension when they're excommunicated from the party in 71?
Well, I did exchange letters with George Jackson, but only for about a month. And the prison systems across America just stopped prison-to-prison communication. I consider George Jackson, he's one of my heroes. He's a great revolutionary, and I think the world lost a great leader when he was assassinated in prison because of his political belief, because of his political activism, you know.
I think we have time for just one more question.
Mr. Woodfox, thank you for being both a student and a teacher of human dignity. A quick preface to my question. So here in Berkeley, the Berkeley police was involved in a plot against the Black Panther Party here to assassinate party members. I was a student at UC Berkeley, and when I was a student, there were maybe 3% of the student population was Latino, maybe 4% was African-American, and now it's less. And so my question to you is, in a place like Berkeley that considers itself very politically advanced...
Would you say it again, please, Simone?
Sure. In a place like Berkeley, which considers itself fairly politically advanced, white supremacy exists here... And I would like to ask you what you would have to say to people of color and white folks who could do a little bit more questioning around the white supremacy that exists here on this land nearby in the educational system here, in the people here in this room, what we can do about the white supremacy that exists both in our society and in ourselves.
That's difficult. First of all, you know, there was a time when I had a great deal of hatred for white people because I saw them as, the source of all the pain and suffering that I had experienced and the injustice and the inhumanity and stuff, you know. I'm happy to say, you know, through education and wisdom and experiences, I've grown out. My mom used to tell me something. She said, "You know, boy, when you look with your heart and not your eyes, you see more." You know, so that's how I try to look at other human beings now. You know, Martin Luther King said in the way he phrased it was the content of character rather than the color of the skin. You know, so you know that's. It starts with you first, how you look at other human beings. A white supremacist is a very dangerous, perverted, evil philosophy in this country. The only way, you know, it is probably the only philosophy that I'm aware of that education can't change. You know, you can raise a person's level of consciousness with the truth, and 9 out of 10 times they will change, you know. There are people in this country who feel that because by the right of color of their skin and the texture they have and their physical features, that they are superior to everybody else. I don't know. I haven't figured out how, other than to stand for what's right, stand for what's moral, you know, and to see when you see people, look with your heart, not just your eyes. You know, the eyes can be misleading sometimes. But the heart usually, you know, tells you the truth. You know? At least that it works for me. You know,
I think that's a great note to end on. Albert, thank you so much for coming. It's been great talking to you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.